FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and the date is August 29th, 2016. We're just about to hit the end of the month, then on to September and October, where, well, if you've been a student of the markets like I have, that's when things are often known to hit the fan. We've also got the election coming up, which is definitely exerting some influence over these markets. And, well, gold looks like it might be taking a breather right now. Maybe it's going to reverse a little bit, correct? It's certainly due for a breather. And, well, as you know, John Rubino, no more astute, keen observer, student of the markets than you, John, and happy Monday.
Hey, Kerry. Thanks. It's nice to get the Fed over with, because that's for people who don't respect the guys running monetary and fiscal policy now. When there's a big Fed speech coming, it's excruciating because it paralyzes the markets. And that's what last week was everybody just waiting for Yellen to make her speech and at Jackson Hole. And meanwhile, you've got these other Fed governors out there contradicting her ahead of time, and then while she's speaking, and then clarifying her remarks by contradicting them too. So you end up with basically nothing, because these guys, they cancel each other out, which is a bizarre way for any organization to function, because normally the way big organizations work is that they have their battles in-house in private and then come to a decision, and then everybody gets on the same page and goes out and pushes the company line. But the Fed's not like that. They've got these guys randomly out there making speeches that contradict what the guy before said and contradict what their boss, Janet Yellen, says. And so you end up with basically nothing, which could be their strategy, because anything they say has downside risk, because the markets are so fragile now. You know, monetary policy has been such a catastrophe for so many really decades now that we've reached the point where we're so highly leveraged that, as we've talked about on previous shows, the stock market is now too big to fail. So they have to be really careful about what they say, because if they, for instance, are definite about interest rates going up, that's liable to spook the interest rate sensitive part of the financial markets. If they, if they're dovish and they say that it doesn't look like interest rates are going to go up anytime soon, that's great for stock traders, but bad for other parts of the economy. And so they risk a crisis no matter what they say. So it looks like their strategy is to say nothing in the aggregate. And so it's good just to get this over with. See, we're seeing the post-Fed pop in financial asset prices this morning, because that's the way it always works. The fact that the Fed says anything, and it's not catastrophically dangerous what they say, leads traders to buy stocks and bonds. But over the following couple of weeks after something like that, whatever pop we got because the Fed spoke is reversed out as people actually dig into what the Fed said and see that there's nothing there, you know, and then things tend to go back down in anticipation of the next focus grouped Fed speech, you know. And so this is kind of a distraction from the real events that are taking place in the financial markets, which are ever increasing debt, ever increasing monetary ease, and no results in the real economy, which leads people to expect even bigger ease from the world's central banks, to the point where it can't be done anymore. You know, what we're hearing from Japan right now is that some kind of shock easing is what's coming next, because Abenomics, which was really the mother of all expansion of central bank balance sheets, you know, they took on more debt than anybody else has ever taken on over the last 30 years. And then they tried to inflate it away by creating huge amounts of new yen. And it didn't work. The yen went up. Inflation actually went down into deflation. The Japanese economy is hardly growing. And so now they're going to do some kind of shock and awe thing, they're saying. And that's the kind of process that really matters, what these guys actually do rather than what they say. So we're going to see this go on until it just flat out stops working. And it's possible we've already hit that point because of what we've seen around the world. You know, the European Central Bank embarked on a massive QE program a couple of years ago. That was the beginning, or that began with Mario Draghi's whatever it takes speech. And Europe still isn't growing. You know, Germany's basically healthy and the rest of Europe is a mess. And mm-hmm. so you're seeing Brexit type political movements spring up all over Europe as people decide in various countries that they're really not being served by being part of the European Union or the Eurozone, and they maybe want out. So turmoil is happening there because central bank ease didn't work. Japan, as I said, is flat on its back and they're going to try something radical. Yeah. And the US, if you believe the government numbers, is doing relatively well compared to the rest of the world. But those numbers are generally bogus. You know, our employment statistics, for instance, look great when you just look at the top line number. But if you look at what's happening under the surface, you see all the jobs are going to people who are 55 and older. And most of those jobs are bartender and waiter type service jobs, which mean we've just got a lot of people going back into the workforce who thought they were going to be retired by now and instead find themselves working at crappy jobs for minimum wage or barely above. Mm-hmm. So nothing is working now. And when that becomes apparent, then all bets are off. But we might have one more cycle where these guys try one more really big thing and the markets are fooled into thinking that it's going to work. And then it fails. And then we have the final crisis of this system. Hard to say, but it feels like the markets are still credulous enough to believe one more round of easing will fix what the previous four or five rounds could not fix.
Yeah, just one more try. We just didn't quite get it right, but this time, just give us one more try and it's going to work. You'll see. Mm-hmm. It's definitely going to work.
One more shot of heroin.
Yeah.
Hey. A bigger shot this time and that'll fix everything.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. It's just we almost had it right last time, right? We almost had it. And, you know, we just got to tweak it a little bit and then it's all going to work, right?
Mm-hmm. It's funny to see this really disturbing aspect of human nature, which is that we tend to fixate on one solution and then repeat it over and over again, even after it stops working. And, you know, in personal lives, that's pretty destructive. But in public life, in monetary and fiscal policy, it's horrendous. You know, if huge government deficits don't work, but we keep on borrowing, we set the stage for a gigantic crisis out there in the future. And if extreme monetary ease and incredibly low interest rates don't work, but we keep pushing rates down into negative territory, then that sets the stage for a gigantic crisis. So basically what we're doing is by repeating something that clearly doesn't work anymore, but doing it on a bigger and bigger scale, we're setting the stage for a crisis that is commensurate with the scale of our mistakes. And our mistakes are vast now. So yeah, what comes in the next 10 years is going to be amazing.
Yeah, you know, during the Great Depression, they did the same thing. Interest rates were kept way, way low and people weren't borrowing money. And even when they were, it just wasn't enough. And it didn't work then. Same thing in the Great Depression, you know, 1929 through 1939. And they always say, well, World War II fixed it. And it really didn't. It was just, you know, World War II, everybody just kind of put their material wants on the back burner. It fixed unemployment because you had all this forced labor in the military. All these guys went off to sea, off to Europe, Asia. And then you had all these people working in the factories. So, yeah, on the one hand, that if you look at it that way, yeah, it cured unemployment, but it didn't fix the Great Depression. Living standards weren't that great during World War II. But yeah, same exact mistakes from the Great Depression. We've repeated, we've increased taxes, we've increased regulation. All these things are deflationary, and all these things have lowered standards of living. Obamacare, all these things have just really compounded all the issues, all the problems that we've been going through. And, you know, we don't learn anything from history here, John. That's what you learn from history, right?
Well, the problem with the Depression is that people drew the wrong conclusions from it.
Yes.
And the conclusion that today's monetary authorities and legislators mostly have drawn from it is that the government didn't spend enough money early on and didn't aggressively ease fast enough to offset the debt implosion that came from way too much debt taken on in the 1920s. And had they done that, we might not have had the Depression in, you know, 1933 or 1934. We might have limped along without getting rid of that debt and in fact, accumulating more debt. And then we would have set the stage for a bigger crisis later. That's what we're doing now. You know, we have responded to the tech stock bubble bursting and the housing bubble bursting with ever increasing amounts of debt. And we've avoided, you know, the kind of outright 25% unemployment, you know, soup lines around the corner kind of thing that we had in the 1930s. But the cost has been that the debt we took on back then, you know, in the 1990s and the 2000s hasn't been gotten rid of. We've piled new debt on top of that old debt. And now we have all these zombie institutions walking around, dead, but still, you know, functioning in some way, and governments that are more indebted at any time in human history, and currency creation on this vast scale that nobody really knows what to do with now, you know? And so everybody's leveraging themselves to the hilt in response to the signals that are coming from governments who have pushed interest rates down to the point where it makes no sense not to borrow huge amounts of money if you're a corporation. You know, you borrow a ton of money, but you don't put it into a factory because you don't trust the future, but you buy back your own stock. And if you're an individual, you can't save for retirement with a bank account because the bank account doesn't pay you anything. So why not borrow a bunch of money to buy a new car? And so we're leveraging ourselves at every level of society in order to prevent the debt liquidation that should have happened in 2002 or 2009. And in the process, we're just creating a bigger problem out there in the future because the numbers keep getting bigger and bigger. You know, the debt level of the global financial system in 2000 was already historically unprecedented and already pointed towards a huge crisis of some sort to get rid of that bad debt. And in the meantime, since then, in order to stop that debt liquidation process, we've taken on something like $100 trillion of new officially reported debt and several hundred trillion dollars of stuff that is debt, but isn't called debt, like unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare and the European versions of those programs. And if you include derivatives, then we've taken on, you know, half a quadrillion dollars more debt in that time. Mm-hmm. So the only conclusion that you can come to is that we've just made everything worse. But the guys in charge don't think of it that way. They think of it as, oh, we succeeded. You know, we prevented a depression in 2002. So we must be doing something right. So let's keep on doing what we've been doing.
Right.
Let's borrow more money. You know, and if debt to GDP goes up by another 20 or 30 percentage points, so be it. You know, it went up by 50 or 100 percentage points, depending on the country that you're talking about, over the last couple of decades. And we're still here, you know.
Yeah, unemployment is fine.
4.9%. Yeah.
We're doing great.
By all the headline numbers, we're doing okay.
Yeah, everything's fine. Nothing to see here. Just move along and trust your leaders because, you know, they're doing everything right.
Well, yeah. And that is actually the opinion of an awful lot of people out there. The Democratic Party now under Hillary Clinton is mm-hmm. running on a platform of more of the same. Let's stay the course because what we've done in the last 8 years has worked so well. But what we've done in the last 8 years has just been to take on vastly more debt. You know, we're like a family that has a breadwinner lose a job and instead of scaling back, just puts their current lifestyle on credit cards. And to the neighbors, you look fine. You know, you've still got that big SUV in the driveway and you've still got the big screen TV on the wall and you're still taking nice vacations. But of course, you're doing it all with debt that's going to blow up on you at some point soon. Mm-hmm. That's the global financial system. So I think it blows up soon, but I've been saying that for a long time. So it's possible they stretch this out for a while, but the cost of stretching it out will be just so horrendous, except for people who own a lot of gold and silver. Yeah. Because we've created conditions which are perfect for precious metals. You know, a negative interest rate world is paradise for precious mm-hmm. metals, because it used to be that because gold and silver don't pay you anything, they had a huge cash flow disadvantage when compared to, for instance, treasury bonds. But now if government debt, 13 trillion of which is out there trading with negative yields, if government debt actually costs you something to own it, then gold and silver stored in a vault where you pay 1% a year, let's say, for storage fees, that's looking pretty good now. So yes, it's no surprise that those metals prices are starting to firm up, and the miners, the gold and silver miners, have really rocketed so far this year. So there might be a correction coming up just because they've had such a great run. But the conditions of the world are such that these are things that have legs now. So let them correct a little bit, and we've got an entry point, maybe the last phenomenal entry point for gold and silver miners that we're going to see in the next decade.
Yep. Agreed. And you just don't know what's going to happen next. But yeah, so right now, though, it appears that gold and silver definitely could be taking a breather, and the miners could be taking a breather, the juniors anyway. I mean, that remains to be seen, but it certainly they've performed so well. You wouldn't be surprised to see them pull back a bit at this point, for sure.
Yeah, because, right? Kerry, you have a lot of people in the miners who have doubled their money so far this year. And when you double your money, you want to protect those gains, right? You don't mm-hmm. want to be round-tripped, because then you feel like an idiot. So there are a lot of people out there who are willing to take some money off the table. And that's the kind of thing that can snowball. When you have a really sharp move in either direction, you create the conditions in which you get a pretty sharp move in the opposite direction, just because so many people have so many gains and or losses that that they want to do something about what just happened. And so you could see that in precious metals, where we get a fairly serious correction that takes these things down 30, 40, 50%. But remember, they've already doubled, tripled, or quadrupled. So a 50% drop after something is quadrupled still leaves you up from where you started. But it also creates the conditions in which it flushes out the weak hands and moves that stock into strong hands, and creates a situation where you get a nice move after that. And since the overall environment for precious metals is just the best it's ever been, really, I think that buying the dips is going to be the smart way to approach this market for the next few years, rather than selling the pops, which is what you should have done over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah,
which is something, unfortunately, I didn't do. But
me neither.
Now buying the dips looks a lot smarter than it previously was.
Yeah, that's for sure. And yeah, you know, according, I'm having Eric Haddock on later this afternoon. He's been pretty spot on with his projections and on the precious metals markets, well as oil and other markets. And he says probably a decline in precious metals for the third quarter and the rest of the year, but coming back strong in 17 and 18. And kind of along the lines of what you've been talking about here, of the way you see it, because you're just not going to see markets shoot up the way they've been going indefinitely. You know, it's a process when these markets go up. And hey, you never know. I mean, I'm not real good at telling the future, that's for sure. I've been very bad at it in the past. But trends, picking up on trends, you know, this is a longer term trend the way I see it. So hey, we will sit back and we'll see what happens. But some type of pullback certainly seems in order. Looks like it's happening. The stocks have pulled back from their highs. But hey, let's wait and see. That's why you should never be super anxious to, feel like panic. I missed out. I missed out. What am I going to do? You know, that's the worst time to get into a market, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately, markets create those feelings in people pretty regularly. when something starts moving, it tends to move really quickly. Like this year, I think, was such a dramatic move. When something quadruples in 6 months, that tends to leave a lot of people behind. Because if you were looking at some little miner and thinking, wow, this thing looks basically pretty solid, but God, the stock price is implying bankruptcy risk, you know, so let me wait. Mm-hmm. And then it quadruples on you. And then what do you do? You know, that's the kind of humbling experience that anybody playing with volatile kinds of securities feels always. You know, that's just your normal state of affairs. And so you really have to kind of feather in and feather out and hope your average price is acceptable. It'll never be perfect, as if you bought right at the bottom and sold right at the top. So you can't compare your results with this perfect in hindsight set of trades that you could have made if you'd known what was going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen in the short run. Yep. So, you know, if you sold a little bit on the way up, and miss the eventual high, that's okay, because you'll be able to buy a little bit on the way down. You'll miss the eventual low probably, but you still might average out to a really nice performance record in gold and silver stocks over the next few years if you tend to buy when they're dropping and tend to sell when they're rising.
That's really the key, isn't it? So anyway, if you haven't checked out John's work, dollarcollapse.com, sign up for his newsletter, go over to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. We've always got a link to John's site there, and check out our newsletter as well. Just opt into the mailing list. John, we will talk to you next week. Be well.
Thanks, Gary. See you then.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.